What I'd like to talk to you about is a specific project that was developed in the Gulf Coast with funding from the Regional Coordinating Center for Hurricane Response out of Morehouse. And this actually provided me with an opportunity that I had been looking to be able to realize for a long time. When I first came into the Gulf Coast area, it was clear to me that there was the need to develop a network so that all services that were directed to the under or uninsured could actually be coordinated and maximized in their effectiveness. Unfortunately, there are turf issues that, you know, if you're in an organization, you know what I mean. And it became very difficult to try to establish that network. But after Katrina, basically everybody was open because the need was so great. And everybody just could not close their eyes and turn their backs. So the opportunity to start developing a network presented itself, and I was very glad that I was able to be there to take that opportunity and move it forward. This project was framed under the idea of how do we maintain continuity of care for patients with chronic diseases in the aftermath of a disaster. And basically, the philosophy behind this project was the issue that the immediate response model actually looks at taking care of critical injuries, preventing environmental exposures, and preventing the spread of infectious diseases. However, that model forgets about the needs of patients with chronic diseases, our diabetes, hypertension, cardiovascular disease patients, who need to be in a continued management mode and for whom discontinuation of that treatment will eventually lead to either acute or chronic complications. So the basis for this project was to look at the needs of those patients. And in setting up the project, these were the objectives that were set up. First of all, I wanted to identify the critical chronic disease management needs in the immediate aftermath of a disaster and those from the provider, the patient, and the community-based organizations that provide services to those patients. After having identified those needs, identify the elements of a community-based network that would cover those needs, and finally define the resources required to make such a network functional, again from the provider, patient, and community perspective. Now, Katrina devastated the Gulf Coast area of southwest corner of Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana. However, this project focused on Mississippi and the southwest corner of Alabama, mainly for two reasons. Having to go into Louisiana would have required tremendous, much more amount of resources, but also we understood that the conditions in Louisiana were a bit different from those in Mississippi because Mississippi did not have to sustain the prolonged flooding that New Orleans had to sustain. So they were a little bit more speedy in starting a recovery phase. And in the bottom of the slide, you can see the specific area that was covered by the project. And the very important thing for me is we were crossing state lines. The University of South Alabama is located where it says Mobile, Alabama. And then that is in Alabama, the state of Alabama, Mobile County. And we were able to work across the state line, across county lines, with a system of care that covered the whole Gulf Coast of Mississippi, the counties of Jackson, Harrison, and Hancock. And here you see what's the safety net infrastructure of that area. Starting in Mississippi, that's a very special system because there is just one federally qualified system of clinics that provides care for the un- and underinsured across the Mississippi Gulf Coast. And Singing River Hospital is the major hospital for that area. Coming towards your right, you will see Mostelar Medical Center and Bayula Battery Rural Health Clinic. Those are already in Mobile County, and they are the major providers of healthcare to the Bayula Battery area, which incorporates a strong population of Vietnamese people. And then the three other systems, the USA Medical Center, Mobile County Health Department, and Franklin Community Health Center, are charged with taking care of the health of the heavily urbanized section of Mobile County, those three systems actually cover more population concentration than the other systems where the population density is not as big. Now, all of these systems experience some level of distress. Of course, Mississippi was the most affected of the six permanent clinics of Coastal Family Health Center. All of them were either severely damaged or gone, and it took them about a week to work on the one that had been the least affected, and then they started providing services with one site from the six sites that they had had before Katrina. Now, the study was developed in three phases. First, we wanted to gather data, and that we did in phase one through key informant interviews, focus group with patients, and the establishment of an advisory board. In phase two, the advisory board formulated recommendations, and then in phase three, work groups of key informants who had not been part of the advisory board reviewed those recommendations, and then a formal report was produced. We are now in the process of printing that report. This study was conducted from July 2006 to September 2007. This slide gives you an idea of who participated in our study. There were 14 distinct institutions, including hospital, community health centers, commercial pharmacies, not-for-profit pharmacies, community-based AIDS support agencies, and health departments in the two states, Alabama and Mississippi. And this gives you a description of what were the demographic characteristics of our key informants and where they were located. With focus group participants, we had four focus groups made up of patients. Two of those focus groups were entirely made up of HIV/AIDS patients, and the other two were just other chronic disease patients. We had three focus groups in Mississippi and one in Alabama. The one in Alabama was HIV/AIDS patients. Now, in this slide, I'd like to talk to you not only about data collection, but about data analysis. In phase two, we invited 14 of the key informants, one per each of the institutions that had participated in the study, to conform an advisory board, but only 11 participated. And what we did is we invited them to a workshop, a one-day workshop, where we guide their discussion of topics that we felt had not been addressed during the key informant interviews or that we need clarification on. And after that, the group summarized their findings, and they presented them to their peers, to the other group, and also to our external advisor, who is Dr. Karen DeSalvo. Dr. DeSalvo is the head of internal medicine and gerontology at Tulane School of Medicine, and she had been present pre and post Katrina in New Orleans, so she had a tremendous breadth of experience on the devastation that Katrina caused to the healthcare system and models that would help us rebuild it. So she participated via conference and also produced comments and suggestions. That was all our data collection phase, and then it became the analysis phase, which we turned to qualitative data analysis, the method of grounded theory. Basically, all transcripts of the key informant interviews and focus group discussions were managed through a software program that is called AtlasDI, where you can code each of the paragraphs in a transcript. And the way we did this is two independent analysts read each transcript and coded it for emerging themes. Once the individual coding had been put forward, the two analysts got together and achieved consensus as to what were the emerging themes that the data was presenting to us and actually the nomenclature for the codes. Once that consensus was achieved, then the two analysts also produced a list of codes that were associated with the emerging themes. And finally, a third analyst joined, and a string of quotes that were associated with the emerging themes was produced using the AtlasDI software, and that was summarized and organized by three analysts and put together in what we called a draft report. So now we were done with that analysis, and we were ready to start phase three, which was report feedback. So we send that draft report back to our key informants and ask them to evaluate and tell us if we had forgotten something, if they agreed with the emerging themes, and just give us any information that could enhance the report. Out of 30, 19 provided feedback, and then our data collection and analysis was complete. Now, this is the list of the diseases that were identified as critical. You see HIV/AIDS as the top one, but you have to realize that in a sense we oversampled for HIV/AIDS because we had put two community-based organizations that dealt only with HIV/AIDS. What was not surprising but actually enlightening was the fact that mental health was the second most mentioned, both by key informants and focus groups. And when you see this data, you realize that the type of projects that Dr. Kim is involved in are actually vital, not only because the residents of the communities are affected, but also the healthcare providers. So their house is gone, their livelihoods completely turned around, and so mental health needs are not only for the population, but also for the healthcare providers. And then you see our regular chronic diseases mentioned. Now, a lot of our results come directly from the voices of our key informants, and so this quote explains that the major need that these healthcare providers had was to continue medication regimens for their patients. And so the one solution that they proposed was that patients should be able to fill advanced prescriptions when a storm is coming. Now, that seems to be a very common sense type of solution. However, there are regulatory stipulations within Medicaid and within the private insurance companies which establish the periodicity of refills. Now, you realize that Katrina hit August 31st, so most of these patients had no supply, and yet insurance companies would still not have allowed for them to have a refill if it collided with the periodicity of what they are usually allowing. So our key informant said it's necessary to have something that's called a hurricane override, that when a storm is approaching, any patient should be able to go to their pharmacy and have their pharmacy refill at least a 30-day supply in preparation, stocking before the storm. As I said, this is a common sense measure, but there are regulatory actions that have to be taken to actually implement it. Another big problem was the fact that patients did not know their medical history, neither did they know the names or dosages of their medications, and that created frustration both in the patients and in the medical providers. To circumvent that problem, our key informants advocated for a personal health record and for electronic medical records. They would very much like to see their patients come with a portable document, preferably electronic format, but if paper and pencil is needed, no problem, but a list of their main diagnosis and their prescription medications. However, if you look at the last quote, that may help some patients, but the last quote speaks of a patient that had much more complex problems that wouldn't have been solved with a personal medical record, only a formal system of electronic medical records that could be accessed at distance would have solved the problems of this provider and this patient. This is a summary of some issues that patients and providers had to face when trying to attain medication. Economy post-disaster is cash-based, and the little dollars that people had were not going to be invested in prescription medications. They had to buy their water, their gas, and so on. Hardship because of loss of property, loss of jobs. Even people with insurance did not have their prescriptions filled, because the pharmacies with no electricity could not process claims. And with all the casinos, which were the major source of employment in the Mississippi area, destroyed, pharmacies did not know whether insurance was going to still be valid. So even people who were accustomed to go to the pharmacy and get their prescriptions filled could not get it. So an immediate solution was a goodwill solution. Our providers did dispense samples when possible, but then churches and pharmaceutical companies provided vouchers both in cash and for prescription medications, and that went a long way to solve immediate needs of prescription medications. There were some regulatory actions that eased the pain. governors of Alabama, Louisiana, and Mississippi allowed for Medicaid claims to be transferable across state lines, so Medicaid patients could finally have their prescriptions filled. And then in Alabama, pharmacists were allowed to refill medications with very little documentation of whether the patient in fact had been prescribed the medication. So we heard from our key informants that they had to use their common sense. They really had to gauge the person and see whether it was, you know, they could trust the person and fill a prescription. But the fact that the regulation had been relaxed allowed them to do that. So immediate regulatory action really can mitigate a lot of the hardship after the disaster. But by far, the major source of prescription medications in this environment of lack of financial resources was donated medications and supplies. And our providers did value and appreciate all the help, all the external help they got. However, in some cases, donations did become a problem when they were inappropriate, when they were unsorted. There was not a staff that could, you know, look at those boxes and sort the medications to give them out, or many of them had expired or were close to expiration. So our providers were very, very vocal in explaining there is a set of medications that we need. Send us this type of medication, and they said it in their own words, medication that will help them deal with their chronic disease patients. So a suggested formulary has emerged from our study, and this is what our providers told us that they would like to see donated. You have the list there, and hopefully this will be moved forward so that it becomes a base for donors and people who are requesting donations to explain exactly what is needed. Now, providers did explain that disaster preparedness is actually the key to face a disaster, and they gave us some elements of what their preparedness should cover, which you see in the bullets in this slide. However, if you look at these two quotes, and I'll give you a little bit of time to read them, you will realize that the level of preparedness is, you know, the difference in level of preparedness is tremendous. The first quote speaks to basically nothing more having been advanced. The second quote speaks to a system that's ready. And the difference between these two is not the will of the people, it's actually how much administrative support these organizations have put into preparedness. The second system, the CEO, immediately after the disaster, produced funds to buy generators, designed who is the person responsible in our system for disaster preparedness, and give this person resources so that the person could actually organize the institution. So everybody knows what has to be done, but until administration doesn't put resources behind the knowledge that preparedness is needed, then things are not going to happen. Now, important issues that were stressed by our key informants was the coordination of internal and external aid. The second quote in this slide speaks to the need for internal coordination within local agencies, and the first quote speaks to the need of some coordination of external aid. What our local agencies and providers wanted to see is for people to come into the community, but to come and coordinate with them, because they felt that sometimes people were trying to do their best, but with no guidance, and then efforts were duplicated, or resources were not distributed to where they were the most needed. With medication coordination, our providers said it's necessary that we communicate before the disaster so people know what kind of medicines they should be sending, but they also proposed that a centralized coordination body be established that would receive and sort the medication, and then that body would make sure that the distribution was decentralized so that people could be accessed in their communities and they did not have to come to pick up the medication. So a set of policy recommendations comes out of our study. Some of them are of regulatory nature. Some of them speak to the need for resources to establish specific functions. The first one is of regulatory nature, the issue of being able to relax public and private insurance stipulations of refill periodicity when a storm is coming so that patients can stock. In order to circumvent the problem of patient knowledge of medication, our community health centers express the need to have resources devoted specifically to patient education, so they have the opportunity to have their clients understand and know what they are being treated and how they are being treated, what their medical history is. Also, resources are needed for providers to distribute summary health and medication information, either, you know, paper and pencil or in electronic format. A strong call for the need of community health centers to have medical record access. That would help them with electronic storage of their data and circumvent the pictures that we just saw Dr. Wagner show us. And also because a lot of these providers were taking care of displaced patients, then it would be necessary that this system can be accessed across institutional boundaries, and this may be our very first opportunity to actually have these systems interrelate and interconnect for service to their patients. And finally, the strong voice of our key informants was to be able to have a well-designed, operationally feasible, and well-rehearsed plan for coordination of external aid that would cut across all the agencies that are major responders in the wake of a disaster, because they felt that it's only through shared leadership and the work of external volunteer organizations alongside the local organizations, that kind of work is the one that will actually promote long-term impact and sustainable recovery in the region. In closing, I would like to acknowledge the support provided by RCC to this project. I would also like to mention Mary McLean, who, although is not listed as an author, provided tremendous support in the data collection process. And finally, acknowledge the collaboration of our partners in Mississippi and Alabama that graciously let their employees talk to us, and to our 30 key informants and 28 focus group participants who saw graciously share with us their experiences in facing Katrina. Thank you very much.